Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. These two gentlemen have been involved in the defense side of every transition over the past four decades. Guys, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be back, Vago.
Great to be here, Vago.
An absolute pleasure having you both on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. I want to start with you, Michael. It's been a little while since we've had you guys on. We had a little bit of activity in terms of nominees last week. Mike McCord, who did a terrific job as a comptroller during the Obama administration, is going to be back. Mike Brown, who continues to head the Defense Innovation Unit, has been selected to become the Acquisition and Sustainment Undersecretary, and Ron Moultrie to go over to intelligence, highly qualified folks. Colin Call has already been named, whereas all the other guys have not yet been named. And you both have talked to us about the tyranny of the schedule, or rather the importance of the schedule, if this administration is going to move any needles and do some big lifts, certainly before the midterm elections. Michael, walk us through where we are and what the challenges are as you see them, given there are still an enormous number of jobs that are unfilled.
Well, thank you, Vago. As you said, today is the 80th day of the Biden administration, and there are 61 Senate-confirmed presidential appointees at defense. Two of them are at work, the secretary and the deputy. One, the undersecretary for policy, is awaiting confirmation. And last week, three more were just announced. But this leaves 55 top jobs in that department unidentified and also vacant. The situation's about the same at state, though. There are 80 plus political ambassadorial appointments of the Trump administration that are now vacant, and those mostly in the largest countries in the world. So far, Biden has named only one ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, to be the ambassador to the United Nations. To my knowledge, no other country has, or more importantly, ever has had nearly half of its ambassadorships vacant. So this calendar and these vacancies are a very big deal. Over.
Arnold, where are we in getting these jobs filled, right? I mean, because we've been talking, you know, every couple of weeks when you talk to folks who are involved in the process, they'll say, look, I mean, the service secretaries are coming. We have them settled, but they're not really quite settled. And on the one hand, critics say they're not moving fast enough. On the other hand, when you talk to them, they say, hey, look, we've got the special assistants in place. We've got a lot of very good talent to make sure that the trains run on time. We have a strong secretary and a deputy who know what they're doing. What's your sense about where we are and how many more of these announcements are coming?
Well, Vago, all of what you just described is accurate. It depends on how you want to compare it. I mean, I hate to say it, but the times it takes to get people vetted, nominated, and confirmed has been increasing since the Kennedy administration, where it took about 3 months, to the Trump administration, where it took about 11 months. And frankly, right now, if you want to compare it to the Trump administration, the Biden administration and DOD is ahead of the power curve, because Jim Mattis was the only person there until mid-May. They at least have two people on the job. I think you'll see the Armed Services Committee under Jack Reed and Jim Inhofe move very quickly on the three that have just been nominated. They're all highly qualified, as Michael Baer has outlined. They're quite anxious to get people in those jobs. Certainly, they're going to basically prioritize any new nominees that come up. I personally don't have any insights into the timing of the next batch, but certainly they've been working on it for some time. In terms of Colin Call to be Undersecretary for Policy, He's going to be facing a series of floor votes. The first thing is the majority leader, Schumer, has to have a motion to discharge his nomination from the Senate Armed Services Committee because it came out on a 13-13 tie, and a tie in the Senate is really a losing vote. So he's going to face a couple of weeks of floor consideration, but I'm sure the Senate will get to that when they get back from the recess. So, and I know the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jack Reed, has continued to express concern about the pace and the fact that the committee is quite anxious to move the nominee. So as Michael has indicated, the pressure really is on the executive branch to accelerate their timetable for selecting, vetting, and nominating these individuals. Over.
Let's talk about the quality of the talent that's coming into the department. I think that it goes without saying. So I think this can be a little bit on the brief side because each and every single one of the candidates brings a lot of skill to the job, whether it's Colin, obviously Dr. Hicks and the Secretary Austin go without saying. But talk to us a little bit about the capabilities that Ron, Mike, and Mike are going to be bringing to the department.
Well, Vago, first of all, let me start with Mike. I mean, Mike is, he disproves F. Scott Fitzgerald's assertion that there are no second acts in life. Mike comes back into his old job, and I would argue wiser still from the 4 years he's had away at Stennis. I mean, and as chairman of the business board, Arnold and I worked closely with Mike for years. He knows more about the DOD budget and the process than anyone I could possibly think of in either party. Ron Moultrie, who I work with very closely, is a terrific disciplined intellect and a great leader. He has a lifetime of distinguished work at NASA and the CIA. 2 years ago, Ron served with me on the panel that I led on the Department's cyber readiness. As part of that work, we assembled for the first time the totality of foreign actor executed data and IP losses that the department and its industrial partners have tolerated over the previous decade. That and our many findings and recommendations served as a profound wake up for the department's leadership. And Mike Brown, he just brings so much background in his experiences at some of the leading, some very large cutting edge technology companies. And most of all, he's spent the last couple of years dealing with the procurement issue of our time, which is how to get the best of commercial innovation into the department. So I think these three really exemplify the very best of any party's experiences at the department and nominations. And we're really lucky to have all three of them. Over.
Arnold, I want to, do you have anything you want to briefly add before we go to the budget?
No, I mean, I totally agree with Michael Baer. We know them all well. I hired Mike McCard when Senator Nunn became chairman of the Armed Services Committee back in 1987. He's as good as they come, just like the other two, as Michael Baer has outlined. Over.
I want to try to go to the budget. It was some weeks ago, Arnold, on this program where we got to the number that everybody ended up talking about, that 704 to 708 bracket for the 051. It now looks like it's going to be 715 and that the Pentagon has won a little bit more money, saying, hey, your guys are going to make us spend more money on climate. That means it's got to come from someplace else. Why don't you level us up a little bit and give us a hand? And it looks like that's exactly what's happened. Talk to us about what that means.
Well, let me hit the big strategic blue arrows, Vago, because you're going to have, you know, really the good budget experts on your roundup later. First of all, it sends a signal to those that were advocating for deep cuts in defense of up to 10%, which would have been $70 billion less than what we're spending now. It basically tells them that's a non-starter. I don't think we'll ever see it getting to those low levels. So this 715 provides a modest increase over the FY21 actuals. And it represents a level, a top line level that's higher than the highest peak of the Reagan buildup and higher than the highest peak of the Trump buildup. So these are very large budgets. It approximates the levels that were projected in the Trump administration's future year plan, which is kind of where no real growth budgets. And a number of reviews are underway in the Department of Defense, including a review of the National Defense Strategy. And so until we know the results of those reviews, it's really premature to know exactly how much is enough. We can say, however, the threats from China continue to increase. Congress is going to be making the final decision on this number after extensive hearings and examination. And frankly, I think we should all focus a lot more on what we get for what we spend rather than meeting the bang for the buck, rather than the exact amount. And we certainly should be emphasizing major investments in emerging technologies, which are the cornerstone of our ability to deal with this Chinese threat and also our country's own economic future. Over.
Michael, why don't you give it? And right, I mean, some of the infrastructure investment is designed to do just that, and high technology investment, although there is a lot of debate about the broad contours of the infrastructure, $2.2 trillion infrastructure package. Michael, why don't you bring us home?
Yeah, and I agree absolutely with everything that Arnold and you have said. I think, however, buried in the budget, there is obviously the wins for the department, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Fourth Estate. But the shift away from the Army, though slight, is evidence that the Army Chief of Staff Jim McConville's new vision and strategy, his Army and military competition, is not getting the traction they expected with the Biden administration. And this really bodes watching for the budget and the fight up that will really matter. That is the one that the Biden team will build for fiscal year 23 and beyond.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on, and hope we have some more transition news over the coming weeks to have you coming back on again. I know that we give you guys a break when there isn't a lot going on. So thanks very much for joining us.
From your lips to God's ears, Vago.
Roger, Vago.
Joining us this week to discuss the week in Washington and beyond, our former Pentagon comptroller, Bob Hale, who is affiliated with the Center for a New American Security, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, and former Pentagon comptroller, Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many affiliations includes the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Gentlemen, thanks so very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Vago.
And I should point out that our good friend Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council is going to be joining us later in the program to give us his take. I managed to talk to him yesterday when he was in Morocco about the Iran, or the resumption of the Iran nuclear deal and negotiations, indirect negotiations going on between the United States and Tehran. Administration has put out its skinny budget, a budget outline just coming out minutes ago. A little bit higher than what our consensus estimate was, right? Earlier in the week, began hearing the 715 number instead of 704 to 708. Administration compensating a bit for demands, the climate demands that are going to come out of the Pentagon budget. Bob, why don't you start us off in broad terms, what this means, what's included, and what it tells us, including the discontinuation of the Overseas Contingency Operating Fund that folks have been relying on. But, Dove, I remember when you were comptroller saying that was just simply no way to live, and it lasted 20 years, but it's finally gone. Bob, why don't you start us off?
Okay, glad to. So they've asked for $715 billion in what's known as discretionary funding, what Congress appropriates every year. About a 1.4% increase over the 705 level for fiscal year 21. To put it in context with recent years, the Trump years from 15 to 21 grew at about almost 4% a year. So this clearly significantly slower growth, probably just barely enough to cover inflation. So basically a budget that's flat in real terms. As you said, Vago, it discontinues the request for the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund, which actually debuted in the fiscal 10 budget. I was there for its creation. It served the department well early on, but it has been misused and hated, I think. So I certainly fully agree with the administration's discussion or decision to eliminate it in this budget. So what does this mean for DOD? The Trump administration's number for fiscal 22 in the budget they sent out a year ago was $722 billion, a bit higher, but not a lot than what they've got now. However, that 722 envisioned a much smaller OCO level. So the base budget, DOD has had to do some trimming. And I suspect much of that is already done because they knew this was coming. But the problems in doing that trimming may also have prompted their pleas for a little bit more funding, which apparently were listened to. We don't know a lot on the details of how they'll do it. They've just given some general statements in this so-called skinny budget. But I suspect that given the speed with which they'd had to do this, they probably had to trim some of the acquisition accounts significantly, something that I have mixed feelings about. We need more procurement, and especially procurement. But if I were there, I probably would have done the same thing, because it's hard to cut budgets quickly. We'll see whether they had hoped to have a full fiscal 22 budget on the Hill by early May. I suspect, given where we are, that may be difficult, but certainly sometime in early to mid-May, we should see the details. So with that, let me stop and turn to back to you, Vago.
It's interesting you said that, right? Because one of the bulleted items is divests legacy capacity and force structure, although there is some good news here, right? I mean, it says deter China is number one, supports defense research and development's number two. Number three is optimize U.S. naval shipbuilding, which is good news for the United States Navy. It says modernize the nuclear deterrent. So this sense that the triad remains whole, and it also invests in long-range fires readiness. And then climate resilience, energy efficiency, biological threats, commitment to families. Dove, there are, right, I mean, it's a $1.52 trillion discretionary request. I mean, it needs a little bit of reminding that more than, you know, about half of that is going to the Pentagon. Talk to us also where there are some positive steps from your standpoint elsewhere in the budget and in investment. And it's unfortunate that Gordon Adams can't be with us today to celebrate.
Well, Gordon and I have both spoken on this program about the fact that they really needed to move some monies, not necessarily out of defense, but move more monies to the State Department. And the Biden administration has been very, very vocal about the fact that it does not want to see defense as the default option in every single case. In fact, the first option, not just the default option. Well, the budget that they've just come out with has increased State Department funding by 12%. The total is $63.5 billion. It includes about $3.3 billion. That's really Treasury international programs, but the administration has lumped that with state. And that may not be as much as was spent before Mr. Trump came to office, but it's a significant increase, not as far as the Democrats on the Hill, as many of them wanted to go. But it's a message, and it's a message to the world that Biden is serious about diplomacy. It's a good follow-up, actually, to what just happened in Anchorage, where Sullivan and Blinken basically put the Chinese on their hind legs for a change. And so if you balance that with what Bob has just described, you begin to see some kind of a shift, not a major one, but some kind of shift toward focus first on diplomacy and backed up by the military. And remember, this budget is, of course, really just a hint at what comes when Biden's people will be able to put together a full budget, which would be for fiscal 23.
Do you, based on what you see, I mean, you wrote a piece saying that, look, don't come to defense for cuts because doing it would be irresponsible. From that standpoint, are you relatively satisfied with what you're seeing?
Well, I wouldn't be satisfied, because I think personally, I think where the National Strategy Commission came out, 3 to 5%, where most Republicans are, is probably the right way to go. But that's not realistic in the current environment. I think what Biden did was essentially split the difference between those who would like to go that route and those 50 congressmen who wanted a 10% cut. His message seems to be, I'm not going to do that. I'm Joe Biden. I'm a moderate Democrat. And moderate Democrats don't just cut defense with some kind of sledgehammer. And as Bob said, it's no growth, but it's no decline either. And that, I think, is a major message, too.
I think it's interesting that one of the challenges Joe Biden has is that he's not progressive enough for progressives, but he's not bipartisan enough for many Republicans who may not really even want to meet the president halfway. But that's another issue. So he's a little sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. $2.2 trillion is a huge infrastructure measure, but it's not enough for the progressive wing of the party. Byron, let me bring you in this, because you've been tracking the temperature of some of these debates. I mean, obviously, some of the inter-service rivalry discussions have sort of bubbled out. We saw General Tim Ray, the Global Force Command commander, sort of questioning the United States Army's long-range precision fires plan. We've seen the Navy sort of being pretty comfortable about where he sits. The Chief of Naval Operations, Mike Gilday, in his remarks, has been pretty bullish on the outlook for the Navy. Talk to us a little bit about how you view what you're reading, right? I mean, at this point, very skeletal, but also some of the tea leaves that you're looking at, whether it comes, whether the, 2040 ODNI plan. Talk to us a little bit about some of the dynamics and what you're tracking and what your sense is in all this.
Let me first just go to the budget, Vago, because I think, look, obviously we have a top line figure for the DOD and then the broader defense budget function. You know, there are some hints, as you pointed out, in the OMB summary document. I think the really interesting thing that, you know, the market still is going to have to look at, and contractors as well, is how do you break that all out? I mean, you really can't make easy, quick adjustments to military personnel. I think the comment about climate resilience and energy efficiencies is going to be interesting to see how that may flow through O&M and military construction. RDT&E being supported, okay, that's a good signal. But you know, that last tagline about divesting legacy capacity and force structure, you know, we know that's going to set up another fight with Congress. And to Bob's point, I think it's going to be interesting, you know, when the more detailed budget comes out in hopefully May, where all these cards kind of fall. On the point about, you know, kind of the inter-service debates, discussions, you know, that have broken out in the open recently, I'm a little surprised by it, although I think it's symptomatic of the fact that you still don't have many people who have been confirmed in leading positions in the Department of Defense, including the secretaries of the three major services. There are obvious pivots and shifts going on, China in particular, but, you know, the idea that somehow long-range fires the Army is proposing are just an Indo-Pacific capacity misses the point entirely that in a Russian-European context, that's basically going to be an air and ground battle. And so I just think it's unfortunate to see this stuff kind of break out in the open, because I think these are issues that can be resolved with analysis and internal discussion in the Department of Defense. I really don't look at it as something that, signals a sharp break one way or another. I think these things kind of arise from time to time. So I'm more curious about it than fearsome or fearing it.
Bob, you and Dove, I want to get your sense on this also, right? The challenge for any senior team is both the internal dynamics of it, right? Making sure that inter-service rivalries don't spill out into the open. I mean, you know, there's always a little bit of sniping that takes place, but at this point, every once in a while, you know, there are those who say that it's important to actually publicly air and debate this stuff, right? I mean, that we end up with muddled thinking in part because everybody's trying to make everybody happy and isn't really having as august a debate. And then there is the outside political game where this administration is coming into a little bit of criticism, right? Not conferring with senior lawmakers as closely as they need to, surprising them sometimes. And even folks not really knowing what the budgetary, playing cards so close to the vest that ultimately folks don't really get a lot of, they don't feel like they're being brought in on the decision-making at all. Bob, much to your credit and Dove to yours, when you guys were comptroller, you guys did talk to folks and brief people. And, you know, so very little came as a complete surprise at the end of the day. Bob, why don't you start us off, right? I mean, what's the trick to getting this right and not getting sort of dissolved and disrupted from within, but also doing it in a fashion that doesn't actually alienate the folks that you need on the Hill, because even your closest allies will eventually turn on you. And it's a very, very tight legislative majority.
Well, so Vago, I think the keys are time. This administration is still pretty young, and having political appointees would be very helpful. And of course, we know they are lagging in terms of those nominations. They put forth some very good ones, I think, but we're still up to what, six, I guess, nominees out of 61 positions. So it will certainly help to have them in place. The other key is internal discussions, and I'm not there, so I don't know, but I certainly hope that Secretary Hicks and Austin are bringing the players together and letting the voices be heard before they make hard decisions, which they'll have to make. Let me just add one other thought to the priorities in this budget. Some of them were certainly no surprise, deterring China and research and development. They didn't reiterate, one a little bit surprised to me, a point that Austin made, Secretary Austin has made, that we need to just stop investing in RDT&E and actually try to do something with it. That is not in the skinny budget, at least. And I'll mention one other that surprised me a little bit, and that, because you don't normally hear it in the top list, and that is countering emerging biological threats. It's always been there, and DOD has always invested money, but I don't recall seeing it highlighted in the same way that it is in this budget. We'll just have to wait and see what that means when we get to the detailed budget in May. Back to you, Vago.
Dove?
Well, I think Bob's covered it. I think one big change will be if hopefully Mike McCord is confirmed as comptroller, because as Bob and I both recall, we do a lot of the talking to the Hill. Right now, there isn't anybody to talk real numbers to the Hill in that way. Mike, of course, was Bob's successor. He's widely respected on both sides of the aisle. He knows the Hill backwards anyway, because he worked on the SASC, and that's going to make a difference right there. On the internal discussions, it seems to me that we're looking at these in a very, very different context. Biden looks like he's really serious about downgrading our presence in the Middle East. And that, of course, depends on a whole bunch of things, including the Iran deal, but clearly focusing on China. Now, that creates a huge problem for the Army. As we know, there's a debate as to how relevant the Army can be with its supposed plan for long-range fires and all that in an East Asian environment where general after general has said, don't keep fighting wars there. That in and of itself, plus the fact that the administration does seem to want to increase the role of the Navy and change it, by the way. I mean, the debate over carriers is far from over. Those things in particular, plus the initiatives that General Berger has come up with, all of that leads to a very, very different kind of debate as to which services get how much than perhaps was the case in the past.
Byron, how do you know, you've tracked for decades the nature and the tenor of the public debate. And if it's right, it matches the inner debate, right? It stays gentlemanly, but at least we'll move some needles and arrive at you know, better policy and strategy, ideally, right, for the debate. Well, how do you sense this evolving? Because the Army and many, you know, we had Mike Mullen on the program and Admiral Mullen made the case, look, you know, be very careful about cutting the Army, because the Army really is central to whatever we're going to do, no matter where it is we do it. It, you know, air and naval power, we may move to the forefront, but at the end of the day, you really can't have a lopsided force ultimately, right? And that's one of the concerns now with Britain's defense cuts or investment change is that the Army may be in a very vulnerable position. What's your sense in sort of, you know, and what would be your sort of recommendation on how to do this right in a politically charged time when people are not going to want to leave legacy investment, because that's a euphemism for cuts?
Well, look, I think a couple of thoughts here, Vago. First, you know, defense, if you look at public opinion polls, Gallup or Pew Research, there's not a clamor for higher defense spending. Although, you know, in the past when there have been spikes, those usually are coincident with major security changes. So for example, 9/11 certainly got people focused, got the public focused on security vulnerabilities and a clamor for higher defense spending. And I think if you look at most of these polls today, you know, jobs, economic security, healthcare just remain top of mind. And it's not a big issue in the sense that, you know, representatives and senators, when they go back to their districts, you know, their constituents are going, why aren't you guys increasing defense spending? I think the second part, you know, and this is something the Biden administration has talked a lot about, is there's a broader notion of security going on here that you really have to start working on the foundations of national security, not just, you know, the relative pointy end of that spear, which is the Department of Defense, but do you have an educated population? Do you have a healthy population? Do you have a population that's secure and comfortable in their future and their jobs? And then do you have a technology and research and development base that will keep the U.S. competitive with China? So, you know, this has been going on for a while. I kind of go back to the earlier point that I believe Bob discussed, which is, you know, okay, we're not going to get 3 to 5%, but is 750 or 710 billion, whatever this number is finally done and said with, is that starving the Department of Defense? And it's very hard to make that conclusion. And I just think this is going to be, you know, these numbers don't always stand still for multi-year periods. But I think, you know, kind of just looking at this budget drop and saying it's inadequate, we're way off track, if we don't get 3 to 5%, it just misses this broader context of where we are in thinking about security from a broader standpoint.
I just wanted to jump in. And when I worked for Secretary Bob Gates, he used to fairly regularly say the one thing we're, I'm sure we're going to get wrong is the next war, the next serious threat. And he didn't mean that critically of the department, which he was running, but rather that it's just very difficult. I mean, who would have anticipated in 9/11 that we'd be involved in two major land wars? So I share Byron's and I think Dove's feeling, balance is the key here. Yes, you need to emphasize some things, certainly new R&D, deterring China, both those make a lot of sense to me, but I would be careful about making major cuts in the Army, unless we're a lot more confident than I am, that we won't be surprised again and need them badly.
And that coming from a former naval officer. Go ahead, Doug.
Long time ago.
I would just add remember, by the way, on 9/10, Rumsfeld was totally focused inward on the Pentagon's need to reform itself. So yes. Bob's absolutely right about that. Look, we haven't mentioned Ukraine yet. And you know, yes, we've sent a couple of ships to the Black Sea or whatever, but if Putin calls our bluff, then we're in a very difficult situation. And cutting the army at that point makes it much more difficult to say, yes, we're deterring Putin. By the way, he just got a new law passed that allows him to run for two more terms. This guy's going to be around until they bury him. And he calls our bluff every time, you know, from Georgia to Ukraine to Moldova, whatever, to what he's doing in Syria. So although the argument for cutting back on the army looks strong, I think the army's making the wrong case. Their case is we're appropriate to Asia. That's not the right case. The right case is somebody's got to be able to face Putin down. And that's probably the Army and the Air Force.
Yeah, and Vago, I would agree with Dove's point entirely. I mean, I think the Army, I've heard some Army messaging where, look at how many tanks China has compared to how many we have. I mean, I think there are two thoughts here. One is, to Bob's point, you just don't know where the Army is going to be fighting in 2030, 2032, 2035. Right. And a lot of these procurement programs, they're going to be delivering capability fully in that time frame. And it's a vignette, but I think this idea that one service has all the answers is false. When the IDF crossed the Suez Canal in the 1973 war, one thing that opened up that campaign was the fact that they were actually able to destroy Egyptian surface air missile sites on the other side of the Suez Canal. And that opened up the air campaign for the IDF. So the symbiotic relationship between ground forces and And the rest of the military, I just think you can't assume that one branch of the military has all the answers.
And having a friend who made that crossing before Israeli troops were temporarily cut off and began to threaten Cairo was also what precipitated the end of the war, ultimately, because the Egyptians sort of calculated, wow, okay, this is going differently. Look, if you want to change the dynamic in Ukraine, deploy elements of the 18th Airborne Corps in 24 hours to Ukraine, and that sends a pretty clear deterrent message to everybody, right? Don't mess with us at the end of the day. And I think very, very agile ground forces backed by air and naval power as necessary are critical. Although I have to say, if you're in the United States Navy, you're riding pretty high in the saddle, given that, you know, you're number three on the priority list of a rejuvenated fleet. And I want to bring our conversation with Ilan and go to Iran. You know, as we were talking about this, right, you were saying among the scenarios that maybe change the dynamic, right? I mean, we talked one of them, which is Ukraine. Iran is another one. There's both a shadow war going on between Iran and Israel. Israel recently attacked conducted a mine attack on an Iranian ship in the Red Sea. Latest in a whole series of back and forth going on between both countries, this happening as negotiators were meeting in these indirect talks. I managed to talk to Ilan yesterday. Here's our conversation and how he sees the discussion as well as the Israeli dynamic. And joining us now is my good friend, Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. Ilan, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Okay, start us off. You're joining us from Morocco. Talk to us a little bit about where we stand with the resumption of the Iran nuclear deal. Obviously, there were indirect talks between the United States, or I should say among the United States, its allies and partners on the joint plan of action, as well as the Iranians. There are two new working groups that have been established. What does this ultimately mean? And is the Biden administration behaving thoughtfully as it works its way toward a resumption of the Iran nuclear deal by putting as its condition Iranian compliance, even though the Iranians want sanctions lifted and then they comply?
Sure. Well, there's so what we're seeing now is, you know, best described, I think, as proximity talks, right? It's not direct negotiations between the United States and Iran yet, but it's certainly crawling in that direction. It's crawling in that direction where both sides are laying out their parameters for acceptable direct negotiations. The U.S. has said that it wants Iran to come into full compliance with the JCPOA, but it's also signaled that it thinks that these discussions, if they do happen over the JCPOA, are going to lead to follow-on talks for Secretary Blinken has called a, quote, longer and stronger agreement that encapsulates more of Iran's troubling behavior. The Iranians have said something, frankly, very different. First of all, they've said that there will be no follow-on discussions, that they sort of see any talks that do occur as sort of terminating at a resumption of contacts over the JCPOA. And they've also said that they think that the United States needs to go first and the United States needs to lift all sanctions in a comprehensive manner as a good faith gesture in order to bring them back to the table. So there's a lot of daylight still between the parties, but it looks like they're drifting closer. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that sort of the signaling coming out of the White House is that there seems to be more and more flexibility on the part of the Biden administration to contemplate the idea that it's going to roll back sanctions that, in the words of the special envoy, Rob Malley, are inconsistent with the JCPOA. That's new. That's potentially troubling, but that's the direction in which the White House seems to be moving.
How do the recent deals that both Russia and China have struck, right? I mean, two of the key nations in this negotiating, the five nations or the five organizations, right? The EU, Russia, China, the United States, and Japan, who negotiated this deal. At the end of the day, what do these trade deals between Moscow and Tehran and Beijing mean for the ability to maintain any form of international sanctions?
Right. Well, the bigger of the deals, obviously, is the China-Iran deal that was had been negotiated last summer, was finally concluded about a week and a half ago. And if it's fully actualized, that deal covers everything from infrastructure to joint military cooperation and naval basing for the People's Liberation Army Navy in the south of Iran, and at a price tag of something like $400 billion. This is a big deal, and it's frankly very symbolic of sort of what we can expect if the Biden administration does come to terms with the Iranians, because the big gamble that the administration is pursuing right now is that through a lessening of tension, through a sort of a rollback of maximum pressure, through the promise of increased trade, it can get the Iranians to significantly modify a range of behaviors. But at the same time, what you're seeing is Iran's strategic partners, Russia and China, are doing trade deals that are propping up the Iranian regime in a way that, first of all, will make them more resistant and sort of take a harder line position towards any concessions to the United States. And second of all, even if the US and Iran do come to terms, it's likely to create a situation where US leverage over Iran is still comparatively minimal.
And how is Israel factoring into this, right? I mean, obviously, New York Times had a great story about the clandestine naval war going on between the two parties. Just as everybody was meeting, Israel attacked the Saviz, an Iranian vessel, which is doing counter-piracy operations. So it's not exactly a cargo ship, with a mine attack in the Red Sea. How is I mean, obviously, the message from Tel Aviv, or rather, I should say the message from Jerusalem. Sorry, I was still thinking the Kyria. The message from Jerusalem is, hey, we're a factor in this, and we're not letting Tehran off the hook. How is Israel going to be factoring in these negotiations? Obviously, during the course of the Trump administration, very prominently, now much more of a sideline player, but one that's still willing to flex its military muscle. What does that all mean?
Right. Well, listen, the Israelis are, I think, trying to send two messages. And the first has to do with Iran's nuclear compliance. And there's a delegation of Israeli intelligence officials that are heading to Washington as we speak to brief the Biden administration on Iranian cheating and Iranians obfuscation over nuclear processes as a way of attempting at least to shape the administration's stance as it sort of embarks on these negotiations in earnest. The second message that the Israelis are trying to send is that they're very much a factor in at least the regional equation with regard to Iran's behavior. The Saviz famously, right, we've heard analysts talk about the Saviz being a sort of a logistical jumping off point for IRGC activity in Yemen. Right, although that remains to be seen, but that's clearly the optics through which the Israelis are operating. The Israelis still understand that there's a dimension that isn't being covered by the talks that are underway in Vienna, which is Iran's malign regional activity. And that activity is troublesome enough for the Israelis to send a signal that they're willing to act unilaterally against it. What that means for the larger nuclear negotiations, I think, remains to be seen. But very clearly, the Israelis are sending a signal.
And what's the right way for the Biden administration to proceed on this, Ilan? At the end of the day, it's trying to set a message that the United States is back, it abides by its agreements, but it's also going to be tough, understanding that any cave-in to the Iranians also sends a message to Russia and the North Koreans, as well as China, where the administration, I think, has admirably been stepping up its game to try to confront Beijing. At the end of the day, what's the right way for the Biden administration to move forward to get what it wants, which is a resumption of a deal that would contain Iranian nuclear aspirations, and as they have said, to also contain its malign activities regionally?
Right. Well, listen, it's that latter part that I think is most important. And as you mentioned sort of at the outset, I'm in Morocco currently, and the sort of what I'm hearing here sounds an awful lot like what you're hearing coming out of capitals in the Persian Gulf. Concerns about the fact that this deal, if it's conducted improperly or if it's negotiated improperly, will have an empowering effect on Iran's malign regional behavior. And here in Rabat, as well as other places around the region, there's a lot of trepidation about things like the possibility that the Biden administration might be willing to contemplate a delisting of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps from the US FTO list, which is something that's been sort of raised in the press. the region is watching, and the region is concerned about Iran's nuclear program. But here in North Africa, and certainly in the Persian Gulf, there's a lot more focus on Iran's regional activities. And so the Biden administration, in terms of confidence building with its allies, is going to have an answer to how the new deal, if a new deal does arise, does address that.
Ilan, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, as always.
Dove, I want to bring you in to the conversation, right? It's always a pleasure hearing from Ilan. What's your sense on where we are and what the administration has to do next?
Well, I think Ilan pretty much has it right. The one thing that is a little, there are two things that are worrisome. First, how serious is this Chinese deal? The South China Morning Post, which comes out of Hong Kong and may now be under the thumb of Beijing, tries to play the Iran-China trade deal down. Oh, it's not really that big a deal. It's not much of a threat. There's not much arms sales. All well and good, but if the Chinese have a naval facility in Iran, what does that do to our drawdown in the region? Because what do you think the Gulf allies and the rest of the region will be thinking if the United States is pulling out while the Chinese are coming in? So that's one factor. A second factor is to me, the Iranian elections. I think everybody is assuming that it's going to be a hardliner who will be the next president, which means it may be much tougher to get this Iran deal through. And I think this is why Mali is becoming exceedingly more flexible. He's always been a supporter of the deal and has never been viewed, certainly by the Israelis, as one who's got their concerns uppermost on his mind, or for that matter, the Gulf Arabs. And so there may be a rush at the end to get this done before the elections. And yes, the Iranians are saying we're not going to do a follow-on. Well, if there's a deal and they say we don't want to do a follow-on, then what does Biden do? The Iranians know that some of these sanctions are congressional sanctions and they can't be moved. But, as Mali has indicated, I think the Biden people may well get rid of some of the sanctions they can get rid of. And then the Iranians may move ahead. Whether there'll be a deal or not at the end of the day, I don't know. But I think the Biden administration does see itself running against the clock here. And finally, Ilan's point about the real problem being Iran's regional activities, I think that's correct. Even the Israelis probably see it that way, although they won't admit it. They'll always focus on the nuclear threat, and Netanyahu in particular. But it's the regional activities, the support for Hezbollah in particular, from the Israeli point of view, or the general threat to the Gulf from Iran, all of that is something that may never come to fruition in terms of a deal if this first part of the deal is done and then a new president says, okay, fine, I'm stuck with a deal that my predecessor made, but I am not going to make a regional deal. Then the United States is in a very difficult position indeed.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Always a pleasure having you guys on. Have a great weekend and a great week, and looking forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.